was getting hotter, and its tanks still held another few hundred thousand pounds of fuel. Tom Griffiths was at home with his family in Alvarado, Minnesota, a rural town with a population of about 400 when the phone rang. Griffiths was a civilian fire inspector at Grand Forks Air Force Base, about 45 miles to the south. His job mainly involved teaching the public about fire hazards and looking at blueprints to make sure that new buildings complied with the fire code. His wife was a school teacher at the base. They had a 6-year-old son and an 11-year-old daughter. The kids had gone to bed. George Van Kirk, the fire chief at Grand Forks, was on the phone. The two men were good friends, and they both lived in Alvarado. A B-52 caught fire near the runway about 40 minutes ago, Van Kirk said. Did Griffiths want to come along and help out? Griffiths said yes. The two sped to the base as fast as they could in Van Kirk's Ford Fiesta. By the time Griffiths and Van Kirk arrived, the fire had been burning for about an hour and a half. The strong wind was still blowing the flames away from the bomber, but the fire trucks couldn't put out the fire. Some of the hoses were now being used to cool the wings and the fuselage. The co-pilot had admitted that he might have made a mistake before leaving the plane. Two of the steps in the emergency checklist may have been performed in the wrong order. The checklist said to pull the fire suppression handle for the number 5 engine, shutting off the fuel, and then turn the emergency battery switch off, cutting the power. The co-pilot may have turned off the battery first. Without any power, the fire suppression system wouldn't work, and fuel would continue to flow. Firefighters climbed into the plane twice, entering the cockpit and attempting to perform the steps in the correct order. But nothing happened. SAC headquarters was on the radio, along with representatives from Boeing, trying to figure out what to do. By 12:45, the fire had been burning for almost 3 hours. The right wing and the doors of the bomb bay were starting to blister. The fuel tank inside the wing would soon get hot enough to ignite. Boeing's recommendation was simple. Pull the firefighters from the area, abandon the plane, and let it burn. The safety mechanisms on the nuclear weapons would prevent them from detonating, and nobody would get hurt. For some reason, SAC headquarters didn't seem to like that idea. Van Kirk looked at Griffiths and said, "What do you think?" Griffiths knew what the question really meant. Somebody should make one last attempt to shut off the fuel. "Yeah, let me try it," he replied. Although Griffiths's current job was fairly sedate, he'd worked for years as a firefighter at Castle Air Force Base in California, where many B-52 pilots were trained. He'd served as the crew chief of a rescue squad, a post that required him to lead men into burning planes as everyone else was leaving them. The interior layout of a B-52 had become awfully familiar, and Griffiths thought he could find his way through one blindfolded. But just in case, he wanted Gene Rausch, one of his fire inspectors, to climb into the plane with him and bring a flashlight. Their conversation was brief. "Gene, you want to go with me?" "Yeah." Griffiths conferred with the wing commander, going over diagrams of the console and the position of switches in the cockpit. Griffiths and Rausch borrowed Silvers, hooded firefighting suits, from one of the trucks. The boots were two sizes too big for Griffiths, and he had to grip the insoles with his toes to walk in them. He stuffed a handheld radio in his hood to communicate with Van Kirk, and their conversation was recorded. "Chief, that engine is getting pretty hot," Griffiths said, 5 minutes before midnight. "It's starting to pop. If we're going to go in, we've got to do it now." "Yeah, go." Griffiths and Rausch ran to the plane, entered through the bomb hatch, and climbed into the cockpit. Griffiths realized he didn't need Rausch with him after all. The cockpit was so bright from the flames right outside the window that a flashlight was completely unnecessary. Rausch could have stayed outside in the truck. Griffiths had been in burning planes before, but never in one where the fire was cascading with such force. He had no idea if the fuel could be shut off. But he'd give it a try, and if it didn't work, they'd get their asses out of there. He saw that the fire suppression handle had already been pulled. All he had to do was plug it in. He switched on the emergency battery and the fire went out, like the burner of a gas cooktop that had just been turned off. And then Griffiths and Roush heard everyone cheering outside. As Griffiths walked from the plane, Van Kirk handed him a radio and said, "Here, somebody wants to talk to you." It was General Richard Ellis, the Commander-in-Chief of the Strategic Air Command. "Mr. Griffiths, I want to thank you," Ellis said. Griffiths was impressed that the head of SAC knew his name. He subsequently received a Civilian Medal of Valor, but he didn't consider himself much of a hero. Climbing into a B-52 that was on fire, without power, in the middle of the night, loaded with nuclear weapons, was no big deal. If you're an Air Force firefighter, he thought, that's what you do. During a closed Senate hearing, Dr. Roger Batesel, the director of the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, subsequently testified that if the B-52 had caught on fire, the nuclear weapons inside it could have scattered plutonium over 60 square miles of North Dakota and Minnesota. The city of Grand Forks, with a population of about 60,000, would have been directly in the path of the radioactive plume. Batesel failed to mention that one of the Mark 28 bombs could have detonated. It would have destroyed Grand Forks and deposited lethal fallout on Duluth, Minnesota, or Minneapolis-St. Paul, depending on the high-altitude winds. An Air Force investigation discovered the cause of the fire in Engine No. 5. Someone had forgotten to screw a nut onto the fuel strainer. The missing nut was smaller than a penny. Jeffrey Zink and his crew were taken to the hospital, given drug tests, and kept there until 3 a.m. They later resented the obsession among local newspapers with the question of whether nuclear weapons had been on the plane. The Air Force would neither confirm nor deny it. The crew focused on a more immediate issue: how easily they could have lost their lives. Some of the bombers on alert that night were parked facing west. Had the nose of their B-52 faced west, the fire would have entered the plane the moment the hatch was opened. They would have been incinerated, and the flames would have quickly reached the SRAMs and the Mark 28 bombs. The difference between life and death was their parking space. Not long after the accident, Zink and his wife were having a romantic candlelit dinner. They were newlyweds. When his napkin brushed the candle and caught on fire, Zink came unglued. All the feelings that had been suppressed hit him at once. He lost it. He felt like a complete basket